Welcome to episode 3 of the Man of Starch podcast for Monday, July 14th, 2008. Your source for the polite musings of a real-life high school English teacher and drama coach from beautiful Mariposa, California. In this week's podcast, pod-safe music from Beatnik Turtle and Chris Merritt, a roundup of the top news stories in education and how they will affect you, a review of what Man of Starch has been reading and watching, including David Sedaris' new book, When You Are Engulfed in Flames, and the BBC's 7-Up series. Highlights from this week in history. A calendar of events for all those Central Valley kids complaining that there is nothing to do in this town. The cool website of the week for all you Japanophiles. We will look into the origins of that famous phrase, break a leg, in our segment, Etymology for a Semi-Literate World. And we'll close out on a lighter note with highlights from our small-town sheriff's daily log. But let's get started with our first independent artist of the week, Beatnik Turtle with their song, Freeloader. Enjoy. Was Freeloader by Beatnik Turtle. Lately, I've been feeling like a bit of a freeloader. My wife, Noelle, started a new job on Monday at the nonprofit, the Yosemite Association, just about 30 miles away, just outside of Yosemite National Park. And I am a teacher, and so I've got some time off, and I've been doing the dishes and cooking the meals, and feel like I've had a lot of time to myself since she started work, and I feel like I'm a bit of a freeloader. I know when August rolls around, I'll be just as busy as ever, and for now I'm going to enjoy being a little bit lazy and working on the podcast and on my webpage. Before we get into the news this week, I'd like to make a special call out there for all the Man of Starch listeners. I'm looking for pictures of potatoes or pictures that deal with potatoes. I went to Google Images and it was amazing how many pictures I did find that had something to do with potatoes or French fries or potato chips. If you have graphics on your MP3 player, you'll see that with each podcast I have a different potato-related picture because I am the Man of Starch and potatoes have starch in them, my last name being Starch Man. And so I'd like some of you out there, if you can keep it school appropriate, to create some sort of photo dealing with potatoes, and if you send in something original, I will use it on the podcast for that week and I will make sure I give you credit as well. If you want to take some pictures for me of potato-related things, hopefully something humorous, you can email those pictures to me at manofstarch@gmail.com. All one word, manofstarch@gmail.com. Also, if you'd like to comment on the show, you can drop me a message there. I've got a couple of news stories in the education realm this week to share with you. The first is about a very cool new trend in education, making high school and college campuses more green through the use of alternative energy solutions. More from this week's LA Times. This spring, East Los Angeles College unveiled 5,952 solar panels that generate nearly half of the college's energy. At Santa Clara University, one building has carpet tiles made of yarn, and the entire floor is raised on 14-inch legs so that air circulating below can warm and cool classroom floors. A glass solar chimney aids ventilation. At Santiago Canyon College in Orange County, the library is cooled by vertical perforated solar fins, and a building at Stanford University is built partly of redwood salvaged from century-old wine vats. And in Iowa, geothermal wells drilled 120 feet below the parking lot at Grinnell College's Conrad Environmental Research Area help heat and cool the buildings. Experts who follow building trends agree that in the last decade, as fears of global warming grew and examples of eco-innovation spread online, campus greening morphed from a fad into mainstream phenomenon. The array of solar panels at East Los Angeles College is expected to last at least 40 years and is producing about 45% of the college's energy, or 1.9 million kilowatts annually, for a yearly savings of $270,000. The panels are suspended over 530 parking spaces at a campus parking lot, opposite a baseball field carpeted in artificial grass to save water. The Los Angeles Community College District, which includes East Los Angeles, is undergoing one of the largest green building efforts in the country's public sector, with more than 40 buildings planned and all facilities set to employ only renewable energy. At the time, it was a risky venture. People thought we were throwing money away, said Sylvia Scott Hayes, president of the district's board. We wanted to make a statement, set an example for our students. Scott Hayes said the district struggled to find architects and engineers fluent in eco-friendly techniques when it started its effort in 2003. Now, green consultants do brisk business. At the 10 University of California campuses, a 2004 policy mandating that all new or renovated buildings be eco-friendly has saved the system nearly $5 million, officials say. Conventional buildings account for 36% of the country's total greenhouse gas emissions and 39% of its total carbon dioxide emissions, according to the U.S. Green Building Council. They also consume 71% of its electricity and 3 billion tons annually, or 40% of the world's raw materials. Sustainable facilities significantly lower those percentages. That eco-friendly buildings shrink costs is especially helpful during a time of budget cuts for education. I'm pleased to say that at Mariposa County High School, where I teach, we have a great ag department, and one of the classes they're bringing back next year, after 2 years of budget cuts, is a botany class, where students grow their own plants, and they learn about irrigation and where their food comes from, and then they go on to sell those plants every year to the community. And I think it's important that we get into this kind of green mentality. Even if you're not big on global warming, it just makes sense to be responsible about what we're putting out there. And if you can make that initial investment of putting solar panels in or using gray water or whatever it may be, you're going to have less of a footprint that you leave on the earth, especially when we see third world countries like India and China growing by leaps and bounds. We need to do our part where we can to try to make alternative energy more feasible. I have a friend up here who does this for a living now. He goes in and he retrofits houses to be able to use green energy. And I asked him, on a house like mine, what would it cost to get some solar panels put in and be 100% solar? And he says it's about $60,000 up front, which is a lot of money. You're not going to make that back right away, but he said you use a fraction of the solar energy and actually can sell a bunch of it back to PG&E and make some money that way, because you're creating so much energy through your solar panels that the government will buy it back from you so that they can use it for other households. On a darker note, I bring you our second story of the week. More news about required testing. Most of my listeners are in high school or have graduated, so you've dodged the bullet on this one, because this new test applies to all 8th graders. But I still think it is important to discuss what's going on with testing in California and how it impacts teachers as well as students. Here's a story. Every California 8th grader will be tested in algebra, ready or not, under a new policy approved Wednesday that could make the state the first in the nation to require an upper-level math class before high school. The State Board of Education voted for the change under pressure from federal officials and Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who broke months of silence by siding this week with advocates who want algebra to become mandatory in 8th grade within 3 years. Proponents say the new policy will push school districts to ensure that 8th graders are ready for the demands of algebra. Critics say the anticipated 3-year time frame is unrealistic. The new mandate, they contend, overlooks the real need to help school districts better prepare students. Lucille Zentino, a summer school student at Monroe High in North Hills, typifies both the state's aspirations and its failings. Zentino, 18, was part of an early push to get all students into Algebra 1 in 8th grade. Zentino flunked the class and has been flunking it ever since. Now she is attending classes after her senior year, giving it another try, determined to earn her high school diploma. Zatino's struggles demonstrate the depth of the challenge. Her math slide began at Milken Middle School in 7th grade, then came 8th grade algebra, when her teacher quit and was followed by several long-term substitutes. "I don't think I was prepared. I think they just, like, pushed me into algebra. Math was like a different language I never understood. I felt hopeless." In the Los Angeles Unified School District, more than half of 8th graders, along with more than 2,000 7th graders, took algebra in 2007. But only 21% of 8th graders tested proficient. About two-thirds of those who failed the class passed on their second try. At many low-performing campuses, the picture is more dire. At Gompers Middle School in Watts, for example, only 30% of 8th graders took algebra, and only 15% of those scored proficient. Moreover, only 1% of students in general math, an easier course, tested proficient. Washington couldn't tell California exactly how to comply with the law, said Holly Kuzmich, Deputy Chief of Staff to U.S. Secretary of Education Margaret Spellings. But education policy is leading us to getting kids access to algebra by the 8th grade, and we know that's what leads kids to college and jobs, Kuzmich said. She added, "We are delighted at the governor's push for high standards." Kuzmich said she knew of no other state that required algebra as early as 8th grade. So they're telling us that getting kids access to algebra by the 8th grade leads kids to jobs and college. Every kid has had access in most schools for years. I took algebra in 8th grade because that was what I was told I needed to do to get into a good college. I didn't understand it. I continued to not get it through high school. And finally in college, during a calculus class, everything clicked. And then I went back to reteach myself algebra, because in math, everything builds on everything else. If you don't know algebra, you're not going to get trigonometry, you're not going to get calculus. It's like if I have a kid come to me, and he does not know the alphabet, he doesn't know how to read, I'm not going to expect by the end of the year that he's going to write a thesis paper of a high school or college level. I'm going to start with the basics and teach him the alphabet. If you don't know your basic math, it doesn't matter if they give you a test on algebra and push you into a class. You're not going to get it automatically. And this just seems to be the cycle. It seems to be so frustrating. It seems that they think if that they create a test, then that will force teachers to teach something relevant in their classes, as if we're not teaching relevant material as it is. I hate to get on my soapbox, but this is something that really frustrates me as a teacher, to be told that I have a test coming up, and I have to have students learn this material in time, and they have to be proficient at this level. Here's what makes sense. You don't suddenly next year tell all 8th graders, hey, you're taking algebra whether you're ready for it or not. What you do is you tell 1st graders, all right, in eighth grade, you're going to be required to take algebra. So we're going to start in first grade, not with algebra, but with this idea that you need to be prepared in 7 years to be ready to take algebra. So we're going to start on this path now, and by the time you get there, all the teachers will hopefully be in line, and you'll be ready for it come eighth grade. Because if you're an eighth grade teacher next year, teaching algebra to a bunch of kids who've been forced into the class, you don't know what they did in 7th grade, or 6th, or 5th, or 4th. You don't know they were prepared. Sure, they took math, but not with that mindset that, okay, you need to pass this test by the time you get out of 8th grade because suddenly the state tells you that you need to. I'm all for kids taking more challenging courses, but please, prepare them. Don't set them up to fail, because I guarantee you we're going to have a generation of kids who hate math even more than they do already, because they're going to be forced into algebra and they're not going to be successful, and they're going to look at this as something negative. I look at it this way. One of my best friends is the art teacher. He teaches right across the hall from me. And if you told me in 1 year's time I had to pass an advanced art test, I'm going to fail because I can't draw. 1 year of preparing me for that test is not going to do it. Over time, I may become a better artist, but it's just not going to click with me in that amount of time. I've not been prepared to pass that test. So I don't know why we do this to kids. It's never made any sense to me. I think that what we should really test kids on is how well they work together. We never have a test where kids get to help each other. It's always, what do you know? And think about real life. How often do you have a job where you never interact with anybody else? You never go to other people for sources or the internet? Yesterday I was making salsa. I didn't just throw tomatoes and onions and jalapenos into the food processor. I could have done that, but I went online and I looked for recipes, and then I looked at the reviews and I picked which one sounded the best, and I used that information. I still had to make the salsa on my own, but I was able to use a community of other people who have already made mistakes, and I was able to do it in the best way possible instead of just making all the errors myself and making bad salsa 8, 10, 12 times before I got it right. I don't understand why we don't have tests where we say, all right, how well can you work with others? Because that's really what they're going to have to face in life. And now it's time for the Man of Starch reviews. This week I've got a book to review and a television show. I'd like to start with David Sedaris's When I Am Engulfed in Flames. Now, to begin with, David Sedaris is hard to use in the classroom because most of his stuff is not school appropriate. I do use one or two stories with my class, but I have to be careful what I use. So there is a lot of language in David Sedaris, but I did want to share him with you because he's one of my favorite authors. I first got turned on to David Sedaris when I was driving home from SFO. I think I'd just flown back in from London after visiting my then-girlfriend, now-wife, who was studying in London. And I was listening to This American Life. I imagine most of you know what This American Life is. It's the number one downloaded podcast on iTunes. But if you haven't heard This American Life, every week the host Ira Glass picks a new theme and they have a series of fiction and nonfiction stories based on that theme, be it robbery or murder or Halloween or whatever it might be. That night it was a live show focusing on kids learning music. And David Sedaris was on talking about how his dad had wanted him to learn to play the guitar because he wanted his kids to form a jazz trio, and he ends up taking guitar lessons from a midget in the mall. But David Sedaris wanted just to sing, and he wanted to sing commercial jingles in the voice of Billie Holiday. He then went on to sing famous jingles in a dead-on impression of Billie Holiday on the live show that I was listening to. I'm driving down the road, I'm laughing so hard that I'm almost crying, and I've been a fan ever since. His best book, in my opinion, is Me Talk Pretty One Day. But he's one of those authors that you really should listen to. You need to hear him because he has a way of telling his stories that is just hilarious. Of course, I'm a big advocate of reading the book, but his audiobooks are stellar. And you can download When I Am Engulfed in Flames on iTunes for, I think it's $21. The book's a little cheaper right now because Amazon has it on sale for $14.50. But if you have the money, it's really great. It's about 9 hours long. It's unabridged, and you can listen to him read his new book. He's done a couple of live spots on Letterman that you can probably find on YouTube just by Googling Sedaris, S-E-D-A-R-I-S. And his sister Amy Sedaris had a very bizarre series on Comedy Central with Stephen Colbert called Strangers with Candy. My other recommendation for this week is a sort of television series, I guess it's a series of documentary films, that we've gotten into on Netflix. And so if you have Netflix or you have a kind of independent maybe rental place, you may be able to find these. It's called the 7-Up series, nothing to do with the drink whatsoever. The Up series consists of a series of documentary films that have followed the lives of 14 British children since 1964 when they were 7 years old. The children were selected to represent the range of socioeconomic backgrounds in Britain at the time, with the explicit assumption that each child's social class predetermines their future. Every 7 years since, the director films new material from as many of the 14 as he can get to participate. The latest film, 49 Up, was released in September 2005, and filming for the next installment in the series, 56 Up, is expected in late 2011 or early 2012. And this is the earliest reality TV series, and it's much better than most reality TV series. The first one, 7 Up, was meant to be the only film, and it was filmed, as I said, in 1964. It's about 50 minutes long, and it follows these 14 different kids, and you get to hear their different opinions on what it is to be rich, what it is to be poor, what their plans are for university, if they ever want to have children, all of these different things. And they never thought they would continue with the series, and they thought, well, let's look back at these kids when they're 14, and it continued from there to 21, 28, etc. If you're a big fan of The Simpsons, they recently did a spoof on this where it was every 8 years, and Homer breaks into Mr. Burns' house when he's away and tries to pretend that he's become rich in the last 8 years because he's always been kind of the screw-up of the series. It's been very interesting to see if these kids fit into the pigeonhole or the mold that they thought that they would be in, or if they've grown out of that and become something else. And it's really been entertaining the last couple of ones that we've watched because now they have children of their own and seeing are their children going to grow up with the same aspirations and dreams as they did? Will they fit into their new socioeconomic background as some of them have changed over the years? My challenge is I teach English and I teach drama, and documentaries are really more fit for the history classroom. And I've been trying to figure out how can I get documentaries into theater. And so what I've decided to do with this one is next year I will show the 7-Up, the original one, and I will have the students then pick one of the characters and predict what they will be like in 28 years. And after they've created their character sketch, then we'll watch 35 Up and we'll see how close they got, and we'll be able to have a discussion on the characters in that way. The premise of the film was taken from the Jesuit motto, "Give me a child until he is seven, and I will give you the man." And now, this week in history. It's been a very busy week in history. July 15th, 1789, French revolutionaries stormed Bastille. July 19th, 1799, the Rosetta Stone was found. July 18th, 1940, FDR was nominated for an unprecedented third term. July 16th, 1945, the atom bomb was successfully tested. July 17th, 1955, Disneyland opened. July 20th, 1969, Armstrong walks on the moon. And July 14th, 1985, the first Live Aid concert. And speaking of Franklin Roosevelt, I am currently reading the Tony Award-winning play from 1958, Sunrise at Campobello, by Isidore Shari. It begins in the Roosevelt family's vacation home on Campobello Island, New Brunswick, in the summer of 1921. Franklin is depicted in early scenes as vigorously athletic, enjoying games with his children, and sailing his boat. Suddenly stricken with fever and then paralysis, subsequent scenes focus on the ensuing conflict in the following weeks between the bedridden FDR, his wife Eleanor, his mother Sarah, and his close political advisor Lewis Howe over FDR's political future. A later scene portrays FDR literally dragging himself down the stairs as through grit and determination he painfully strives to overcome his physical limitations and not remain an invalid. I'll stop there and I won't give away the ending, which I did last week to the graphic novel Pride of Baghdad. And my wife, for one criticism of the podcast, was, "Brian, don't give away the endings to books. Allow people to read them if you're going to recommend them." And now some recommendations for all those Central Valley and Northern California kids going, "Is there anything to do in this town?" And I want to start with Ironstone Winery Concert Series. I'm not encouraging underage drinking, but ironstonevineyards.com is where you can check out their concert series, and it's a great place for the whole family. They've got this beautiful outdoor amphitheater. It's in Murphy's, California, near Angels Camp, Sonora, and Jackson, kind of in the gold country. It's a little tricky to get there, but once you're there, it's this huge, huge complex. My wife and I, with my younger sister, went and visited it not too long ago, did the tour. They've got a restaurant on site there, and they bring in some really big-name bands, and so I've got a lineup of upcoming concerts there. All of them are on a Saturday night. August 2nd, they have Chris Isaak and Bo Scaggs. August 9th, Steely Dan. August 17th, Steve Miller Band and Joe Cocker. September 5th, Willie Nelson and Sarah Evans. And October 4th, Bonnie Raitt with the Blind Boys of Alabama. Tickets start at $45 and the sky's the limit on the tickets, but from what I understand, you want to buy the general admission tickets for $45. You can bring your own chairs as long as it's a certain height, or you can rent a chair for $3. They've got huge screens up so you can see the concert from pretty much anywhere. If you want to throw down a little bit more money, you can also get dinner included. And if you don't know about the Blind Boys of Alabama, they're a gospel group from Alabama. They've won 3 or 4 Grammys. And they first formed at the Alabama Institute for the Negro Blind in 1939, and the three main vocalists of the group and their drummer percussionist are all blind. So again, that is Ironstone Winery Concert Series, Ironstone Vineyards, all one word, .com. I wanted to give you a theater recommendation. I mentioned that I'm going to go and see Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street in Sacramento at the Music Circus, coming up in a couple of weeks here. Over in San Francisco, there's an institution now called Teatro Zenzani. It's been there, I think, for 7 years or so. And I took a group of students 2 years ago to Teatro Zenzani. It's kind of like a Cirque du Soleil show with dinner included. And as they serve you dinner, there's entertainment going on. It's not cheap. I wouldn't bring young kids to it because it's a little racy, but Teatro Zenzani is set along San Francisco's historic waterfront. Teatro Zenzani is a bewitching evening of European cabaret and cirque, divas and madmen, spectacle and sensuality with live music and a gourmet 5-course dinner set in the nightclub of your dreams. Tickets start at about $135. It's not cheap by any means, but it is an experience. And you can purchase tickets online by Googling Teatro Zenzani, spelled Z-I-N-Z-A-N-N-I. And as always, I try to find you a cheap alternate for entertainment, and this week I'm going to promote camping. Probably Tuesday of next week, I'm going to go down with, as I mentioned, my good friend, the art teacher, and his 4 kids, and spend the day down at the river, and if they're going to spend the night, I'll probably just hang out for the afternoon. But a lot of these campsites, if you're not going with one of the national chains like KOA, you show up on a weekday, and it's first come, first serve, and for $15 to $30, you can get a campsite. Usually you need to have someone 18 or older there with you, but it's a great place to hang out on the cheap, enjoy nature, read a book, and hopefully if you're near some water, take a swim, as we've had well over 100-degree weather for the past week here in Mariposa, California. And now the cool website of the week. I want to turn you on to japundit.com. I'd like to give a little bit of a nod to Edward Shimura, also known as JP. He puts on a podcast called Japan Talk, which you can go to Podcast Pickle or to iTunes and subscribe to. I've been listening to Japan Talk for the last couple of years, I guess, now. And when I started this podcast, I was kind of mimicking JP's style, and I emailed him for some advice, and he was very courteous and helpful, and I appreciated that. And I've learned a lot just from listening to the way that he runs his podcast with the music transitions and those kinds of things. And so I'd like to thank him for all of his help and advice. And I'd like to turn you guys on to Japan Talk and Japundit.com. It's a podcast that goes into a lot of the weird news of Japan and just the daily news if you want to know what's going on over there. He's been living there for some years now. I think mainly what he does is translating different guides for like calculators and laptops and those things from Japanese into English, and he does the podcast in his free time. So check that out, and that's my cool site for the week for all of you folks who are into Japan as much as I am. 3 summers ago, I had the opportunity to go to Japan for 2 weeks. I applied through the International Institute of Education, IIE, and they partner up with Toyota. And every year there for a while, Toyota was sending 60 teachers from the entire nation over to Japan for free to learn about education and the environment and different things like that. We went to Tokyo, Nagoya, Nagasaki, and Kyoto. I was the youngest teacher on the trip at the time, and I believe that they stopped at least for this year doing the trip, but they do go to Galapagos, and they were going to Saudi Arabia for a while. So if you're a teacher looking at studying abroad, it's a great way to go. Everything's paid for by Toyota, and that's IIE.org, and check it out. And now it's time for Etymology for a Semi-Literate World. This week I didn't look up a single word, but I looked up the phrase, break a leg. Superstition against wishing an actor good luck has led to the adoption of this phrase in its place. The date of origin is a bit obscure. As a theater slang word, it existed long before it was ever documented in print, but the intent of the phrase is clear. It is simply a way of warding off a jinx. It being bad luck to speak of a positive performance, one instead speaks of a bad one. Based on the recollections of actors, break a leg is commonly thought to date to the 1930s, so it probably was part of technical theater slang during the first half of the 20th century. But the earliest actual appearance in print that anyone has found is from 1957, from the 29th May Gettysburg Times. In the theater, they say break a leg to an actor just before he goes on stage, but it really means good luck. There are several false etymologies for the phrase break a leg. One is that the phrase stems from the 1865 assassination of Abraham Lincoln. John Wilkes Booth, the actor turned assassin, leapt to the stage of Ford's Theater after the murder, breaking his leg in the process. The logical connection with good luck is none too clear, but such is folklore. But unfortunately for this great story, there is no evidence to suggest that this is the origin of the phrase, or even that the phrase dates to the 19th century. There are various other false explanations. One is that it refers to bending the leg during a curtain call. There are various other false explanations. One is that it refers to bending the leg during a curtain call. Another is a reference to the curtain's pulls that were allegedly called legs. The opening and closing of the curtains during numerous curtain calls could result in the curtain pulls breaking, or so one might wish. As inventive as these are, the origin is in simple superstition. Breaking leg to the king is how I always heard it, and they said that it went back to Shakespeare's day, but I guess it's not that old. We have Drama Club t-shirts every year, and our last t-shirt last year, we bought at imagemarket.com, and it had a little boy on crutches, and it said, Mariposa County High School Drama Club, breaking more legs than the Sopranos. And now it's time for highlights from our local sheriff's daily log. A bear problem was reported in Parma Bell Road. A rattlesnake was in the bedroom of a home on Ridge Court. A lookout on Pilot Peak could see someone firing automatic weapons in Greeley Hill. A possible burglary in progress was reported at Mariposa County High School. That's where I teach. Hopefully nothing was stolen. I should probably go by the school tomorrow and make sure the theater's okay. A car was driving at high speeds without headlights in El Pratel. A person staggered out of Pioneer Market and got into a truck. An ambulance was requested for an accidental stab wound at Barrett Cove. Aggressive dogs were chasing a runner on Morningstar Lane. And lastly, a man was yelling and cussing at children on St. Andrew's Way. That's 2 times in 2 weeks that St. Andrew's Way has been in the sheriff's daily log, and that, again, is just 2 blocks from where Man of Starch lives. So please, folks on St. Andrew's Way, let's be a little more saintly. So what have we learned this week? Google Images is a surprisingly good source for pictures of potatoes. When you tell someone to break a leg, you're being friendly. If you really hate your fellow actors, tell them good luck. No Child Left Behind is ensuring that no child is left untested. It's getting easier and easier to be green, at least on college campuses. Wineries, they're not just for adults anymore. The place to go for all your Japanese news is japundit.com. It's a whole lot more than just raw fish. David Sedaris is my personal hero, and not just because he can sing like Billie Holiday. Reality TV has been around for a lot longer than any of us would like to admit. And lastly, if you're going to steal something from the high school, please stay out of room one. That's all the time we have this week for the Man of Starch podcast. We're going to leave you with something I picked up over at podsafeaudio.com, a happy little pop number to help us forget this week of 100 degrees plus temperatures here in sunny California. Chris Merritt with Tower of Sand. Until next time, this is the Man of Starch, signing off.
Give it away, she told me, I don't want that. It's just a constant reminder that girls go where you go. Girls go where you go, they'll be there also. Give it away, I told her, 'cause I don't want that. It's only you on my mind, and where you go, I go. Where you go, I go. Where you go, I'll be there. Best reunion of the summer was like imagining a brand new color, and not a mixture of two, like blue and green. I mean a color that no one's ever seen. I seen a part of the spectrum wiped from my memory. When I saw your face, when I heard your voice, baby, I was holding your hand. I crumble like a tower of sand. I, you're telling me to break up the band. I crumble like a tower of sand. Give me a day to prove that I won't give way to all the constant reminders.
I need you now, I'll need you always. Oh yeah, you're walking like you're crazy. So come on, conjure up a smile. If I see you now, I'll see you always. Oh yeah, you're talking like you're crazy. Did you know you're talking crazy? Give it away, my darling, and try this trick. It's just a bitter reminder that I'll go where you go. I'll go where you go, I'll be there also. Best reunion of the summer was like imagining a brand new color, and not a mixture of two, like all